Hello and welcome to another episode of Must See Matches. I am Kieran Lefort and joining me as always is the man behind Must See Matches, Mark Buckledee. Mark, how's it going?
I'm good. Had a nice pub lunch today at the kind of pub where I have to duck in the doorway. And for people who don't know, I'm 5'6".
So you're not a large man appearing?
No, not at all.
No, not at all. Okay. Returning to us from all the way back on episode 3, it's one half of Days of Thunder. A marvellous man appears. It's Dave Ryan. Dave, how you doing?
Doing pretty good. I've shaken off the dead wood. Lee isn't with me this time, so we're good to go.
Yeah, we've given you a night away from your ball and chain, a night away from WCW and rubbish movies starring wrestlers.
Yeah, I got to say, man, calling me in to talk about this match when I am notoriously the bad wrestling podcast guy is a maverick move, and I'm here for it.
We thought you deserved a break.
Yeah. It was quite the oasis, I have to say.
Another fucking Disco Inferno match. This is CM Punk versus Samoa Joe from the creatively titled Punk versus Joe 2. Or is it Joe versus Punk 2? It's Punk versus Joe 2, right?
No, it's Joe versus Punk 2.
Christ, I'm going to have to swap them around on the graphic. All right, cool. It's Joe versus Punk 2, October the 16th, 2004. And it is Samoan Joel defending the Ring of Honor title against
Samoan
Chicago.
Samoan Joel?
Yeah, Samoan Joel. His real name is Joel, not Joe. You've stepped all over my joke. Against Chicago Phil. I want to start with Dave. So you obviously put this match on your list, which is why I've asked you to come and talk about it. What put it on your list, and what's kind of your history and Ring of Honor fandom?
So I suppose the primary reason for putting it on here is that, to my mind, it's one of the two matches that happens in the mid-2000s, both of which, funnily enough, feature Samoa Joe, that I came across in the kind of early days of me being online and going, hey, there's stuff outside of WWE now. You know, I had been a WCW kid growing up. I was left with only WWF, and I wasn't particularly online in the early 2000s. So this match and the Destination X three-way match are the two matches that were kind of like, oh, there's other stuff, and that other stuff is often better. Yes. So that's where I kind of come in at this. I wasn't following Ring of Honor at the time that this match happened. It was kind of, I'm coming to it slightly later. I kind of see the Destination X match first and then start to go, hey, this Joe guy is pretty good. Let's look online for other matches that people are recommending and see how I can get my hands on some of this stuff. And, you know, I watch this and it's just a masterpiece. And maybe for me, I will definitely hear arguments that it's the most important modern independent wrestling match in North America, at least, anyway.
Okay. And Mark, you've previously referred to yourself on this show as a Ring of Honor guy. Did this crop up in the middle of, at the height of your Ring of Honor fandom?
This was before, really, the height of my Ring of Honor fandom. Mm-hmm. So I kind of discovered Ring of Honor about 2005, and I was full into getting the DVDs by 2006. Mm-hmm. And you probably know this by now already. I'm not much of a guy for going back to the past.
Yeah, the anti-Samurai Jack.
So honestly, 2005 and especially before 2005, I didn't watch a lot of Ring of Honor. And because I knew this one was a long match, I'd never seen it. And there's six Ring of Honor matches that we're going to be discussing in the podcast. Mm-hmm. And this is the only one I've not actually seen.
So interesting.
Because I knew that it was a long one, and it's kind of, I'd seen enough CM Punk of this time to think, do I really want to see an hour's worth of CM Punk?
Well, I only found out this was an hour long once I was about 45 minutes into it while I was watching it earlier this week.
When, at what stage in proceedings did you find out not only was it an hour long, but it also wasn't the first time these two men had gone an hour?
Well, the name of the show was a bit of a giveaway, and they do mention it on commentary. But so this kind of happened in a lull in my Ring of Honor fandom. I was really into it when it started up. I had like that first run of videotapes. I worked the Frontiers of Honor show they did in collaboration with the FWA when they came to the UK. And then I would have been at this point, we're at this point in 2004, we're coming to the end of my association of working with the FWA. So I am getting burnt out on wrestling, particularly independent wrestling, I guess.
Your grizzled vet.
Yeah. It's kind of chipped away at me and, you know, left me a penniless and broken man. Mm. Yeah, I wasn't paying attention. I'm kind of relying on you guys to drag me through this because, Undertaker and Shawn Michaels last week, this is a bit of a gap in my wrestling knowledge. Obviously, I know who both these men are. I think even in 2022, everybody knows who these men are. One of them is on national television every week, and the other one has just stopped being on national television quite publicly every week.
You've stumbled into this being an incredibly topical match to talk about.
we've had a bunch of those. We keep doing this
with CM Punk.
Maybe then by the next time you do a Punk match, if there's one left on the list, then he might come back again. It's like doing a rain dance for him.
There is one back on the list, and it'll probably be perfectly timed when he turns up at a random WWE show for some fucking
You're gonna do it Royal Rumble weekend.
So can anybody help out with kind of the story up to this point? Obviously, it's Joe defending his title against Punk. Obviously, there's been a Punk versus Joe one, but beyond that, like, is there any kind of history leading into this match? Because I had to kind of come in completely, just, you know, the parachute effect that we tend to have most weeks.
So this is Samoa Joe's legendary 645 day Ring of Honor world title, and you know, that kind of length of title run did not happen in the 2000s wrestling. It was kind of, especially not in Western wrestling, really, if you think about it. So CM Punk was a big guy. The first one was actually really important for Ring of Honor because it came, the first Joe versus Punk was when TNA were pulling their wrestlers from Ring of Honor for the RF scandal. I won't go into that.
No.
So Joe versus Punk went now a draw, got a lot of people's attentions. The irony is this match was not scheduled to happen.
Nope.
This show was meant to be main evented by Samoa Joe versus Steve Corino. And a week before the show, 0-1 commitments meant that Corino had to pull out.
Yeah.
So basically they scrambled. They took Alex Shelley versus CM Punk. They took Punk out. They put him in the main event and they plugged in Jimmy Jacobs into Punk's spot in the undercard match. So with a week's notice,
I think it was like 5 days, wasn't it?
Yeah,
it wasn't even the full week.
Mm. Yeah, well, Steve Corino not showing up for a commitment in 2004, it's like, is there a why in the day?
If I'm not wrong at the time, Mark, was like, it was like supposed to be Corino's big return to like in-ring competition with Ring of Honor. But I think 0-1 had like, I don't know if it was an injury crisis or what was going on, but it was just like at the last minute, they were like, no, we need you instead of them. So you can't do this show. I remember Punk and Joe talking on that, like the famous shoot interview the two of them did with Ring of Honor about how like annoyed they were at Corino because they weren't planning to do the second one so soon.
And the bastard made them go an hour.
Yeah.
Well, from what I can see, you haven't been there since 2003.
Yeah.
And then basically this happened and then he didn't turn up for a little while later.
Yeah.
Don't quote me on that because I've just realized that I'm checking on Cage Match and Cage Match is quite spotty on how I've searched this.
I think that was his comeback. And I think Gabe has said since that the original plan was not to do Joe versus Punk 2 till the third one ends up happening. That was the original plan for the rematch. So like everybody was kind of annoyed that they were like forced into this situation that by like taking Corino out, which was a big match, you know, Gabe felt the need to give an even bigger match so Chicago didn't feel burned.
Mm.
So we're in a Ring of Honor staple haunt here, the Frontier Fieldhouse in Chicago Ridge. I had a quick look through the sheet, the 104, and we will be covering one other match from this building from the next year. No, 2 years later? 2 years later.
Coming up
quite soon, which I'm excited to talk about. We open this with Punk sitting in the corner of the ring in a very brightly lit, aggressively air-conditioned Frontier field house. You can see and hear everything. He talks about getting beaten up a lot. I don't find this hard to believe. And he talks about one particular time when someone came to his house to fight him, and that's what he equates this match to. Joe has come to his front door for a fight.
Yeah.
Joe delivers his rebuttal promo in front of a fire exit in the tone of a pickup artist chatting up a single mum in a bar. Like, yeah, smooth and sexy, arrogant Samoa Joe is not a good character, I don't think.
It also feels like he was just kind of caught in a corridor,
yeah,
like when he was on,
yeah,
his way for a piss and he was told, yeah, like, you have to cut a promo. Punk's, yeah, just done, yeah, this, like, broody, intense promo about getting beaten up a lot. We need a riposte, sir.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen the backstage interview parts from the shows that Ring of Honor did at the Liverpool Olympia, where they chose a random basement room? So it's just this really dark, oh, dingy brick wall behind them.
Isn't Jimmy Jacobs challenged BJ Whitmer to come and fight him in the basement? It looks like he's, yeah, sitting in a toilet. It's terrible.
I love when companies go to buildings and just pick the most obscure location within the building to do, like, WWE were great for that for a while, where they'd have, like, you know, Rob Van Dam doing his stretches in what looks like, you know, some sort of Victorian basement somewhere.
Hey, I can speak having to have to do that. I had to shoot promos with the aforementioned Steve Corino, and we needed 3 weeks worth. So he brought an extra shirt with him, and we went and we found
just the one.
Yeah, yeah, it was in the closed off bar area of what used to be a cinema in Newport, Wales, where we'd had the show. And I'm like, we need 3 weeks of TV promos out of you. And the last one he had to do sitting on the floor. And I had to sit down there with him so we could have because the front of the bar was covered in a piece of corrugated iron, and it was a third different backdrop for a promo.
What a pro.
So this was a time that Corino went to the UK where the airport security didn't meet him with a poster pointing to it saying, "This you."
Yeah, he was fortunately and unfortunately allowed into Wales. So the gist of Joe's rebuttal is, sure, I didn't beat you within the time limit last time, but what you're overlooking is you also didn't beat me.
Yeah.
Punk comes out to the track that 1,000 Twitter dickheads needed explaining to them when he used it for a night in AEW, AFI's Miseria Cantare.
Oh, thank God someone finally explained that to me.
Yeah. His entrance is slightly tempered by being able to see a basketball scoreboard on the wall behind him, yeah, as he poses on the ropes with the lights flashing and his epic music playing.
It's somewhat less atmospheric. Yeah. See the home and away.
For people that haven't seen it, the Frontier Fieldhouse is essentially, it's a box where Americans play sports.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah.
I watched this crowd with a can is loud as hell. Yeah.
I watched this with a can of Coke Zero just to spite Punk's love of Pepsi. Joe's lower third name graphic should more accurately be called everything but the upper third, because it's,
oh my God,
massive. And I had forgotten how generally ugly early 2000s indie wrestling graphic design was. There's, yeah, like five fonts before the match even, yeah, starts, and they're all horrible.
If it was even a couple of years later, I'd swear they did it as a bit. You know, because it's so ugly.
This is pre-robot arm, which is a brilliant bit of... So the robot arm was at one point, Ring of Honor had this graphic with like this fake mechanical arm moving the match graphics. But the best bit about it was the Ring of Honor board at the time, Gabe had hyped that something big was coming, and everyone was basically thinking, is it a wrestler? Is it this? Is it that? And it was this match graphic, and it's like everyone just lost their shit. Yeah. I have fond memories for the Ring of Honor message board, which... I will say repeatedly, some of my better friends I met through that board. Mm. It was also full of assholes, but I met some friends.
Some of the assholes
and friends are the same person.
It's, yeah, a Venn diagram.
That's the message board life, friends.
Oh, yeah. Yes. I realized that between this match happening and now, Punk's gear has got smaller and tighter, while Joe's has got larger and looser.
Yeah.
Also, for someone that was such a big part of wrestling of this decade, Samoa Joe has the most basic ring gear you can possibly, yeah, get.
I noticed this was also possibly the most svelte I've ever seen Samoa Joe. Like, he was bordering on being in good shape. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, which is funny because ironically, he was in very bad shape at the time. He had a really messed up leg coming into this match, which you wouldn't know the fact that he comes out and wrestles a whole hour. But I was reading like excerpts from the shoot interview again before we recorded this, and he was saying that like he had messed up his leg, I think, a couple of weeks beforehand. I can't remember offhand what match he said it was in, but the night before he wrestled, because this was the second half of a double shot for Ring of Honor, and on the first night he ended up having to get cut out of his kick pads. It took about an hour to get them off.
Jesus.
Homicide and Punk had to help him out of his kick pads. That's how swollen he was. It was so swollen that he said even Mick Foley, who was in attendance, said he was surprised that Joe was wrestling.
I'm going to get my moan in now about the production.
Yes.
I'm well aware that technology has moved on since 2004, but that hard cam is blowing out the highlights, something fierce, and no two cameras match for the next hour.
Oh, it's that white indie white balance.
Where the white balance is independent on each camera. Also, on a show that was entirely taped, they have a habit of cutting to the hard cam while the operator is half asleep. Like, and just missing someone like rolling out of the frame and not following them, or not following somebody on a run, or not being able to zoom out wide enough to get like a guy in opposite corners.
Yeah. Right. I wonder as part of it, like for me and Mark, that it's like Stockholm syndrome, that like we, having watched this stuff the first time around, is like we're just used to that kind of like horrible jank.
I said, I was producing independent wrestling television at the time. There's a very good chance that my shit looked exactly like this, but like seeing it now with the extra years of experience under my belt, it's so obvious and looks so bad, and many companies haven't learned.
The problem for me is my formative years of watching wrestling was both this level of video quality on DVDs and the Japanese wrestling I was watching was like 240p video files off like Mediafire and like really tiny grainy stuff. So
those blurs are working stiff.
I have incredibly low tolerance for wrestling quality. Can I work out those are two fit human figures? Can I tell them apart? Good enough for me.
He only found out that Kenta Kobashi wasn't a bunch of blocks last year.
I'm still not sure.
So Punk gets the multicolored streamer treatment. Joe gets a couple, but he's hardly Misawa at Budokan. And they start. They wrestle a lot and well, and it's a wrestling match with wrestling holds, and it's really nice stuff. It's fighting for holds. Punk has a headlock he likes to go back to a lot, which is apparently a callback to the first match. Punk removes some tape and a bandage he had on his back that doesn't come into play in any way whatsoever. It just seemed like he had something stuck on him that was annoying him.
He had like, it was for an actual back injury he had.
Right.
Apparently he put this, when they were putting this match together, he was lying on the floor of the locker room with an ice pack on.
So this is an hour between the walking wounded.
Yeah, it really was.
Jeez. Yeah. There's a couple of thigh kicks, but it's all kind of holds and reversals until Joe, like, he lays in some forearms to keep Punk in a head scissors, and that's the first 10 minutes of the match out of the way. 215-781-2500 for all your wrestling merchandise needs. I'd forgotten that they would plug the hotline during the main events.
Gabe was in full-on Glengarry Jim Ross mode there. Yeah.
DVDs are for closers only. Oh yes, the commentary team are a man called Jimmy Bauer, who is actually Gabe Sapolsky, and a man called Mark Nolte, who annoyed the piss out of me, and we'll get to him later on.
He annoyed
the piss out of a lot of people, including CM Punk once, who on commentary buried him. And this commentary is taped after the fact.
Yes, I know.
Well.
And I also have to assure you, this wasn't Nolte's worst performance I've ever heard.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, this is on the lighter side, the milder side.
I mean, this isn't... Quickly, Dave, who would you say is your favourite Ring of Honor commentary team? And why is it Dave Prozak and Lenny Leonard?
Oh, you've just taken the words out there. I gotta, you know, I try not to, like, overly fond in the past. So I will also give big shout out to I love Ian Riccoboni.
He's excellent.
As Claudio called him, Riccoboni last week on Dynamite. I think he's great. I think he's one of the most like consummate professional play-by-play guys in the business now. But yeah, Dave and Lenny Leonard are just... I was so sad. It was earlier this year, wasn't it, that Lenny announced he wasn't doing commentary anymore. And if there was a guy that deserved to make an absolute shed load of money commentating pro wrestling, it's Lenny.
I want to also mention Caprice Coleman, who when he first started was very bad and is now very good. He and Riccoboni make an excellent team together.
They really do, yeah. Mm. Yeah, I love it when the two of them come out on AEW to do the Ring of Honor matches. It's great.
Yeah. So, as we mentioned, Punk is very much favouring this headlock. He keeps it on for long periods and like it's always his go-to every opportunity. So if Joe breaks out of it and manages to strike him or reverse it into another hold, like Punk's instinct is to go back to this headlock.
So the first act of this match is characterized by the chin locks and the headlocks. Mm. And something I love so much that was uncharacteristic during the legendary Joe title run was Joe getting visibly annoyed that he couldn't wrestle his match. You didn't see that a lot. You didn't see it that much during the first match either, because Punk's strategy, he was doing the chin locks, he was doing the headlocks, but his main strategy, as was noted on commentary during this match, was the rope-a-dope, try and tire Joe out. But that let Joe do his strikes and everything like that. Whereas in this, he just couldn't get a flow going for, what, about 30 minutes of this match was...
Mm. Yeah.
Worked around the headlocks and the chin locks, and it was great.
And the other thing is, speaking of the time and that, so the first 20 minutes or so, all grappling. Before the first Joe Punk match, Joe's longest match, I think, for the Ring of Honor title was 25 minutes and 4 seconds.
Yeah.
No, it was 20 minutes and 4 seconds, I think. So it's like really short, tight matches. Yeah. And so Punk's strategy is, well, Joe can do that and just keeps winning that way. We're going to stretch it out. He tried stretching out one way. It didn't work. So he's trying it a different way. Yeah. He's using the same strategy, but a different way of going about it.
And this is something insane. Like Joe's, I want to say 28th defense of the Ring of Honor title. And like, this is the first time you've seen him. Like he genuinely doesn't know what to do because he keeps thinking he's gotten rid of the, you know, the chin locks and the headlocks and he can get going. And then just Punk brings him right back down. And it's just, he's getting tired. He's getting angry. There's a couple of points where he thinks he's like whipped Punk away and just Punk, he's determined. He knows exactly what his strategy is and Joe is not throwing him off. It's great.
Mm. So Jay Lethal teleports to ringside somehow. they do some shoulder blocks. They go into this rope running high spot. Joe misses the Kawada kick, leaving himself open to a Punk roll up. And Todd Sinclair counts like he's left the fucking iron on.
Yeah.
He counts so fast in this match. Joe is out of two though, and he scrambles to the floor, and this is where he really starts to get frustrated. There's a fan giving him shit and he backheels the dasher board in front of him, scaring the hell out of the fan for a microsecond, which was tremendous to watch.
They had done an extended bit with a heckler in the first match, which ate up a couple of minutes of the match. And I thought, you know, when I watched this the first time, that's where it's going again. But yeah, it's just like the kick is just like, don't fuck with me tonight. Mm. I'm not here for this fun and games.
This is kind of where we head into act two, where the striking really starts. Like they're in a double knuckle lock test of strength type deal. And Joe's having none of this and just starts headbutting his way out. And then he's in with the palm strikes and the forearms and then kicks Punk in the back of the head, knocking him outside. And Punk's like, all right, we go back to the knuckle lock and then gets hold of Joe's arm. And this is now what he's going to target and work over.
Yeah.
Punk also tells a fan who's been chanting boring that if he doesn't like it, there's the door.
Yeah.
Old CM Punk.
Yeah.
18 years later and he has as much chill.
Yeah.
Yeah. Big Phil, a man who is notorious for taking criticism very well.
We get a Punker Taker rope walk, which probably should have been called skipping school or truancy, I guess. And ends it with a leg drop across the arm, which I'd never seen before, but apparently he used to do a lot.
Yeah.
Much more impressive than an Undertaker flying chop. Every time Joe strikes or powers his way out of a hole, Punk is a step ahead and he's back with the wrestling, like the head, the arm, whatever. So Joe tries the old rope-assisted push-off to escape a headlock, but twice Punk hangs on. And then on the third attempt, Joe instead pulls them both out through the ropes, and Punk still has the headlock clapped on. And I thought... Yeah. Oh, they're going to do a stupid spot where Punk keeps the headlock as they do a lap of the ring. And nope, Joe just picks him up and back suplexes him on the bare floor. And now he's out of the hold. You do not mess with Samoa Joe.
No. Absolutely not.
As some wrestlers have found out to their cost in legitimate situations.
And yet CM Punk decides to mess with Samoa Joe in a second.
So back inside, Joe batters Punk for a short spell. Punk avoids the face wash, and after the correct contrivance to get Joe in the right position, connects with his own. There was a lot of kind of attempting each other's moves in places here, particularly the face wash and the they do stuff with the Olay kick later. They were very determined to kick each other in the face.
And that's what, like, if this is act two of the match, the thing I love about this is, okay, you're thinking Punk is like, I've executed my strategy of tiring him out and I've got him slightly annoyed. So now what I'm going to do is I'm not going to let him hit his move. And I'm going to hit his move.
Yes.
And I'm going to really throw him off his game with this. And it working the first time he does it. And then when he does the Olay kicks later, that's when, okay, now I've made Joe too mad.
Yes. Too many times I have poked the bear.
Yeah.
Yeah. Joe comes back with a horribly painful looking leg lock, chin lock stretch, and then does his trademark nope out of the way of a twisting crossbody off the top.
Oh, it's so good.
Joe walking away from people jumping at him is always funny.
Best sidestep in the game.
Yeah. So he batters the fuck out of Punk, connects with the face wash. And
there's an amazing leg sweep at this around here where it's like leg sweep straight to the shins.
Yes. And so Punk just he jumps over the first one and drop kicks Joe while he's still on his knees. And then Joe's like, no, I'm going to do this, and hits him with the second one and clamps on the Boston Crab. Punk gets the boot up on a corner charge as Joe is preoccupied with staring down the ref for admonishing him for his more heelish tactics, and then hits a wonky boosted Hurricanrana off the middle rope. Rey Mysterio Jr. he is not.
No.
But damn it, he was going to try in this match. Yeah.
And I like, again, in the story of the match, this is where, okay, Joe is getting a little bit too aggressive for me. I now have to get a bit more risky with my strategy. Yeah. So I'm going to do a Hurricanrana, and then, like, right after he does a Tope Suicida. And it's, it just makes, you know, every step of this match makes sense for these guys' motivations, for what they would do were this real, you know?
Yeah.
And one of the things I love about the match so much is that it's not like, you know, in the modern era of North American wrestling, you get what, you know, in NXT we'd call the forced epic, where everybody is so preoccupied trying to have a great match and they're hitting 1,000 massive death moves and they're kicking out 100 times over. Whereas these guys are just, they're not trying to have an hour epic. They are just wrestling really well for an hour and telling a very simple story. And I love it.
Yeah. And I'm kind of being facetious for the lols, but like, aside from this Frankensteiner and another one he tries later, Punk is mechanically excellent in this match. Like, for me, he's usually a you get the idea wrestler with a lot of his stuff, and he's more about the storytelling. And for all the Bret Hart love, like, excellence of execution was not the part he aped.
No.
But I think this might be the overall best executed Punk match I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Like, he's crisp on practically everything.
Depending on what you value most from a wrestling performance, this is one of the best bell-to-bell performances of his entire career. I would say definitely the best of the pre-WWE era for me. And like, I'd have to look back now that it's done at his whole run in AEW, because I loved everything he did for the whole year, but I would find it hard to touch it in terms of like an actual, like you said, a mechanical performance.
So like, as you mentioned, Dave, he does the tope and they spend some time on the outside, and this is where they trade the Olay kick. Punk hits two of them and then tries a Hurricanrana off the ropes, off the apron, sorry. And it's not his night for that move as he gets swung into the barrier and then gets his head kicked off by Joe. Yeah. In the absence of time calls, some dude in the crowd tells us we've hit the 40-minute mark.
Can we also talk about how when in doing the Ole, when Punk does the Ole kick, he scans the crowd and looks to Dr. Keith Lipinski to get his energy to to achieve this kick. I can whenever I see this match, I cannot escape the looming presence of Dr. Keith and his notebook right beside Punk.
So was Dr. Keith with the notebook?
Yeah.
I see. Because I noticed there was a guy with a notebook, and then later on, the same man has a notebook in his hand and he's on the fucking phone with the other. Like, oh, hey, honey. Yeah, they're going a bit longer than I thought. Put mine in the microwave. I'll be home soon.
Well, no, this was the era where when shows were going on with the Ring of Honor message board, people were designated at the show to ring someone else who was designated at a keyboard. So they would ring the person with notes to type up to put on the message board. And that went on pretty much to what, the 2010s?
As soon as
basically people could access message boards on their phone, by which point the Ring of Honor message board was dead anyway. But literally that was something that was happening. You'd literally have pairs of guys you'd have one calling in or texting in and the other one putting it up online. So I don't know who's doing it.
I'm picturing the stampede of reporters running to the phalanx of phone booths in Airplane and knocking the whole lot over. Yeah, it's just, you know, with people in CM Punk t-shirts and questionable body odor. So Joe's on a tear now. Punk gets STO'd out of his boots. He gets crushed with the elbow suicida and the commentators abandon the booth and we get the final 15 minutes with no commentary, which is a blessing in some respects.
Yeah.
This is where I want to complain about Mark Nolte. He has a voice like a Simpsons character. I think it's one of Burns's lawyers. Sounds very similar to Mark Nolte to me.
Blue-haired lawyer?
I can get that.
You're
right. You know what I mean. He refers to Punk as CM, which sounds just as ridiculous when Alex Marvez did it All Out.
Mm-hmm.
I never need to hear him call a back suplex a Greco-Roman backdrop ever again. And as we mentioned, Jimmy Bauer is Gabe Sapolsky jumping on the assumed name bandwagon back before Twitter became a thing.
I'd like to think that Gabe was sitting there going, like, when it starts going towards the closing 20 minutes, he has this self-aware moment, this rare moment of self-awareness where he's like, we can only ruin this.
Yeah.
So we should walk away.
ROH did this a couple of times with really good matches. Usually they'd actually do it earlier, like literally as the match is about to start, it'd be like, okay, we're just going to let the action call for itself. I'm trying to think of examples, but I know they definitely did it before. I will give, not Mark Nolte, I'll give Gabe a little credit here because I've never seen the first Joe versus Punk. And just the job of the commentary of giving you that little backstory if you hadn't seen it did help the match for me.
He wasn't
awful. We didn't get full on backdrop driver dangerous screaming.
By the end of Punk Joe 2, I also felt I knew enough about Punk Joe 1.
Yes.
Yeah.
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 So Joe hits a spear, which isn't something you see him do very often. Something you see him do even less often is a top rope splash, which Punk thankfully rolls away from to avoid becoming CM Paste. I was going to say it's a shame Joe didn't do this very often because his form is really nice, but then his knees, probably less of a shame for those. So Punk escapes a powerbomb and he goes on a mule kick rampage, but takes a lovely snap power slam. When that doesn't get the pin, Joe rolls over into the cross arm bar and Punk has to fight to get to the ropes.
Also, at this point, we're probably not far off 50 minutes. And aside from the power slam, the Ole kicks and a couple of spots, there have not been that many of like the big moves from either guy. So they've spent like 40, 50 minutes. And it's not felt like a waste of time, but you know that they've saved stuff for the finishing stretch.
Yeah. If this is booked in, say, a WWE or an NXT now, they've both kicked out of like half a dozen muscle busters and Pepsi plunges by now.
And are staring at their hands.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Punk spikes himself on his head with the second dubious Rana I mentioned earlier, and he mafia kicks Joe for a near fall. He keeps up the offense, suspended neckbreaker out the corner, tornado DDT, anaconda vice, which gets the crowd up. Joe puts the brakes on a brainbuster attempt and lariats Punk to death to stay in the game.
Yes.
He then steals from a whole bunch of people the Dean Malenko press gutbuster, the Randy Orton punt, and fuck it, let's say a Tomohiro Ishii brainbuster, all get a two count. Punk.
Well, there was this sad thing that Joe, for a couple of years in Japan, struggled to get traction because people saw his moveset and thought that he was too much of a cosplay wrestler with all of the moves that he stole from from other wrestlers like Kawada, Misawa, that kind of thing.
He also didn't help himself much. He had what was sort of known as the 0-1 stink on him.
Mm.
So like that was his company of choice in Japan. They were the people that booked him.
But you say that Alex Shelley was in 0-1. He did New Japan later on.
Hmm. I think it's different for juniors.
Low Key was in 0-1, and he got through so many companies where he burnt bridges all of his own.
Yeah, he managed a career there in spite of being low key.
He carries dynamite with him to blow up bridges.
Yeah. The only person that blows up bridges easier is Cody Hall.
Punk blocks a lariat and he hits what is now Andrade's finish, the hammerlock leg sweep DDT, for his own two count. Before I watched it twice and I never figured out how Joe managed to duck the Pepsi twist. That seems like a complicated thing to do because you're so tight in together.
Mm.
Like he almost, it's almost like he glitches through Punk's arm to end up on the other side of
through
it.
Him, yeah.
Yeah. And does his powerbomb kick out STF deal and then transitions that into the crossface. And again, Punk is in the ropes.
Crowd is losing it at this point.
Yeah. Oh, God. Like
it's, you know, that the last couple of minutes has been building and building and they're just completely unglued now.
It's just constant noise.
Yeah. So Punk scores two counts with a sunset flip and a shining wizard, the latter of which is not helped by cutting to the hard cam. So you can barely see Joe just get the back of his hand on the bottom rope. Yeah. With a better camera angle, that would have looked amazing. And I just thought that the referee held up his count when I first watched it.
You want them to have the camera angle of when Kevin Owens did the one finger
on
the rope.
Yes, exactly that.
Yeah.
Pepsi twist, moonsault, two count. Joe has
a brief
comeback.
Had Punk ever done a moonsault before at this point?
Well, he has occasionally joked that the CM stands for crooked moonsault because he was always rubbish at them. But this one looked pretty good.
On the Punk moonsault scale, it's pretty high.
On the Terry Funk to Kenta Kobashi scale, it's not on the low end.
That's quite a scale.
What an interesting scale.
I couldn't think of a really good moonsault, so I chose Kobashi.
So Joe has this brief comeback with a load of slaps and a pump handle thing that almost dumps Punk right on his head. But Punk ducks a clothesline, slaps Joe in the sleeper, forcing him to escape with a backdrop driver, which Punk fighting spirits up from, and they double down off simultaneous clotheslines. This is the only, we're like 58 minutes in, and this is the only point where they've done like a, what could conceivably be called a rest.
Yeah.
Because like even the holds and stuff earlier on, it's not rest hold stuff, as we mentioned, like it's fighting for a hold or to get out of a hold.
Yeah.
Punk threatens the Pepsi plunge, and when Joe resists, he attacks Joe's neck with Austin Powers judo chops, which made me laugh. Joe persists in putting up a fight. They have this epic battle on the top rope, culminating in a superplex from Joe. And because we're going 50-50 here, they then go up in another corner. Punk hockey fights out of a muscle buster, fails again to get the Pepsi plunge, and Joe connects with what looked like a super fisherman buster, but I think they're probably going to call a muscle buster off the top rope as the time runs out.
Yeah.
Oh, also there were no official time calls in this match. The closest you got was hearing Jay Lethal giving Samoa Joe tips, and then 10 seconds to go, Bobby Cruz realizes he has a microphone.
I don't know if it was the same on the ROH message boards at the time, Mark, but I know that like in the entire history of me seeing people talk about this match online and since I've seen it myself, the one big hackneyed complaint about it is that they weren't doing time cues the whole way through. Now, I don't think live in the building that really harmed it at all, because I think the crowd still are absolutely losing it, and they seem to have a self-awareness that it is going to the closing stretch even without the counting.
I also think that they were so absorbed in it that they didn't realize or care that they were going that long.
Yeah. Mm. The other thing is, so the other side of the coin is, the problem with doing time calls is, for a promotion like New Japan, which does time calls in every match, it's fine. So I was at, so when Pac returned to British wrestling, Pac had a match with Will Ospreay. Mm-hmm. And basically they did 5-minute time calls for that match. And as soon as the first time call happened, the crowd immediately let out an audible groan because they knew the match was going to end in a draw.
Because they hadn't done it for any other match.
Because they hadn't done it for anything else. So the problem with doing time calls is, if you're going to do time calls, you need to be consistent, because otherwise it's a clear giveaway. It's a poison chalice. Yeah. It works if you do it all the time.
I do accept the argument that some people say that because you have the context that the first match was an hour draw, that you could do it, you know, as a, you know, because it went an hour the last time, we're going to do time cues this time. But I definitely, like, on the whole, completely agree with your point. Yeah, you give away the farm, and it's kind of part of why Iron Man matches are so hard to make consistently compelling, is because you've essentially told your live crowd and your TV audience, if it's televised, that you're going to go an hour, so it's okay to tune out because the interesting stuff isn't going to happen for 50 minutes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm someone that has once attended a 28-minute long half-hour draw.
Were you sitting next to Gadge, who was timing it?
No, I think I actually watched it later on, and I kind of noticed, wait, hold on, the DVD time point's about 28 minutes. It was Takeshi Morishima versus Dave Mastiff. And as weird as that sounds, that was a great match. That was when Dave Mastiff was pulling out Corkscrew Arabian moonsaults.
Yeah, I remember that era of Dave Mastiff. Yeah. back when he still pretended to be South American.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Mark, you said this is your first time seeing it. What's your takeaway from this match? What's this got for you?
It's incredibly well wrestled. They do a great... I mean... Let's compare this to Shawn Michaels versus Bret Hart, which is the other 60-minute long match that we've covered on the podcast. It's like, I think they tell a better story. This is constantly engaging. I don't think there was any point where I'm actually, I mean, there's points where I'm clock watching a little bit, but there's no point where I'm getting distracted by anything else on my first viewing. Whereas I literally had to watch Michaels versus Hart, pausing, actually telling myself, no, put the bloody phone down, and then starting again because it struggled. So it's constantly engaging. It's great action. They tell a really good story. The only thing really that hurts it for me is just my concentration problem with 60-minute matches and really long matches. So I really, the only other thing is the finish, the logic of the finish is great because you've got the duel between the Pepsi plunge and the muscle buster have very similar setups, so you can do a really good tease for both moves. But it kind of felt that they were run. Basically, it felt like they'd started the spot too early, and they should have combined it into one.
I kind of thought about that, and I have developed a dislike for the time running out at two on a pinfall, which happens way too much. Like that contrived thing
it's
happens.
It's too much of a trope.
Exactly. And this felt like, if there wasn't a time limit, they just would have kept wrestling. So the third match is a no time limit match. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Like these guys, they kept going. And like, if the time limit had been 90 minutes, they would have still been going. If the time limit had been 2 hours, it felt like they would have still been going. Like it was almost like the time ran out in the middle / 2/3 of the way through their match.
Yeah.
And I kind of like that.
Another thing that's kind of interesting about how this match ends and how the first match ends is that Punk can very much have an argument in the first match that he nearly had Joe when the time expired, whereas this time Joe can say he nearly had Punk. So you have the perspective of, I nearly got you and you couldn't beat me. which, you know, again, then justifies the third match down the line.
Mm. Yeah. As I say, I think this is a great match. And in of itself, I'm not so sure that I'd say it's must see, but I think in the context of two facts, one being this is part of this Samoa Joe title reign, which basically cemented Ring of Honor as a promotion you needed to follow.
Yeah.
And also it's kind of that establishing moment for that 2000s class of indie wrestlers.
Yep.
Because I don't think we'll ever get a class of wrestlers on the indie scene as good as those guys from, say, 2003 to 2006, 2007 were. Mm. So, yeah, it's a great match, and there's some really good stuff. And just one little thing that made me laugh when I spotted it. So this was a five-star match from Meltzer in 2004. Mm-hmm. The last match on US soil that Meltzer gave a five-star was the match we covered on our last podcast.
The
Taker
Hell
versus
Cell,
Michaels, Hell in a Cell.
Yeah. Yeah. And that would be the last WWE five-star match until Punk and Cena at Money in the Bank.
Yeah, I think it would be.
Yeah.
Which
whereas this one was Joe's first of, was it two or three five-star matches over the next year?
First of three in a year, and we're going to be covering four Samoa Joe matches on the podcast. Three of those are the five-star, and the other one is one hell of a thing, and all of those took place within one calendar year.
Yeah. I will definitely, for me, during this period of time, like you said, it's an all-time class of independent wrestlers, Mark, for me, Joe was untouchable during this period of time. Like, he's head and shoulders
2004
above.
To 2006, Samoa Joe is kind of that, maybe end of 2005, but that kind of 2-3 year period, it's like there's not many wrestlers, especially on US soil, that you could say touch that.
Yeah. Like, over a longer period of time, you'd say Danielson is more consistent in terms of, like, he's having great matches over a really, really long period of time. But, like, as a, you know, an isolated run of, like I said, 2 or 3 years, Joe is just like, I've never seen someone hit such consistent heights.
Well, the Ring of Honor stuff, and then he goes into TNA and it's like a whole new level. And he also throws in the dream matches. He's still doing random stuff. Like, during his TNA run, he's still doing IWA Mid-South appearances, for goodness sake.
Yeah. I think, like, I consider this, obviously I put it on my list as a must-see match. And two of the reasons, one is obviously the historic significance of it that you went through so well there, Mark. But the other thing is that I think the actual nuts and bolts of this match has a timeless quality to it for me. It doesn't have a lot of the tropes of 2000s independent American wrestling that would seem kind of dated or quaint now. You don't have guys just doing, you know, like I said earlier, like a million super death moves or, you know, superfluous flips or the why am I so violent hands or anything like that. It's just, it's a really well wrestled 60 minute match. And I think anybody that tries to have those dumbass forced epics needs to be sat down afterwards and shown this match because they are not doing what they think they're doing in making an epic. This was an epic match and one that I think coming out of it raises the profile of Joe because he's already, like I said, it's like his 28th defense, but it still elevates him as just this unbeatable monster. It elevates Punk as the guy who has taken Joe to his limit twice, which is unheard of during this reign. And number three, it solidifies the Ring of Honor title as being this huge prize in the sport and something that these guys have now spent 2 hours killing each other for.
Yeah, I read some of the observers that came after this. I was trying to find the one where Dave gives his rating, and it's like, it's not until he gets the DVD in November and he dedicates a full page to this match. And basically one of the conclusions he comes to, not conclusions, but like one of the things he says is like, there are basically two titles in the world that mean shit right now. One is Kenta Kobashi's and the other one is Samoa Joe's.
Yeah.
Yeah, this very much like cements the title, cements the company. And like he, one of his things is like, if you are going to vote in match of the year this year, you have to see this. This has to be in consideration before you vote for anything else.
That's before Dave went absolutely nuts with his 7 stars and stuff like this. He would always say his criteria for one of his criteria for the 5-star match is it's a career defining performance. And it's a career defining performance for both men, and it's a defining performance for the company and the belt. It doesn't get much more historic than that kind of encounter.
Yeah.
So as for me, I know I've seen a good match, but for me, something was missing. And I don't think being parachuted in to watch it as a one-off helped very much. I think as like a diehard Ring of Honor fan at the time, or someone who's gone back now, this is undoubtedly the business. I also think the commentary, presentation, setting, and I'm going to say even the crowd sometimes let it down a bit. So the crowd are loud, but the split is such that they don't seem to be particularly for or against either man, despite it being Punk's hometown. So Punk is like de facto babyface, I guess. But his one good guy quality seems to be he's from here. He's our asshole.
Yeah.
But not all of the crowd are on board with that. Like you see almost as many people like cheering and clapping for Joe when he does stuff and he's getting near falls.
I think his babyface performance is fantastic in this match, but it's very hard at this period of time to be the babyface against Joe because they love him.
It's sort of, it's much like Mark's reaction to The Undertaker last week. Punk ain't exactly CM Morton here. Like he doesn't do anything to get you on his side other than he might be your neighbor in this town. I did like that it felt tactical. I didn't like that the only person in the ring who seemed to feel any urgency in registering a 3 count was the referee. I never felt like, and I mentioned, it's got, sort of going against what I said earlier, where it's like, I liked that it seemed at the finish, at the end when the time ran out, that the match could just keep going. I didn't feel urgency from either man to win.
Yeah, I can get that. I can get that.
Yeah. So with all of that said, though, I went out of my way to praise Punk's mechanics earlier. And you two are both right. Like Joe was on an absolute tear over the course of this 2-year run and then kept it up when he walked into TNA next year. And basically all that stopped it was bad booking in TNA when they drew a knob on his face. Also, their cardio is beyond reproach. Like for obvious reasons, they're breathing heavy late on, but they basically do a 60-minute match at a 20 to 25-minute pace. And that's incredible. And they don't miss a thing. Infinitely more impressive and a better watch than the last hour-long match we watched on it. As you mentioned, 5 stars from Uncle Dave. Currently sits at 9.56 on Cage Match. For reference, the Punk versus Joe 1 got 4.25. Joe finished 3rd in Wrestler of the Year in the Wrestling Observer newsletter, behind only Kenta Kobashi and somebody we're not talking about yet. He and Punk were 5th and 9th, respectively, in Most Outstanding. They came 3rd in Feud of the Year, and this match came 3rd behind Kobashi versus Jun Akiyama from July the 10th and the WrestleMania 20 main event. So there we go. Anything else to add before we wrap this up? A sea of blank faces.
Not really. I think it's one of those, like, it's always hard to tell people. It's an hour-long match, and you have to see it if you haven't before. But honestly, like for all the reasons I've stated, with the historical significance and the timeless quality to the work they put in there, this is one of the very few hour-long matches that I would say you probably should watch at some point.
Yeah, there's more to it than just the bell to bell, and that was I think that's kind of what I found hard, particularly if I'm having 60-minute match fatigue. After having to watch Brett versus Shawn Michaels. Mark, do you have anything else?
No, just one weird thing that I just noticed. So we said we'll be covering 6 Ring of Honor matches in the podcast. Only 2 of them actually contain Ring of Honor guys on both teams, both sides. So 4 of them will contain guest Japanese wrestlers. The only other one with 2 ROH guys is between 2 guys called Brian and Nige, or Dan and Nige even.
Okay, so Dave, thank you so much for bringing us this match, and thank you for joining us to talk about it. The floor is yours to plug whatever you would like to plug.
Well, my pleasure as always, gentlemen. Thanks for having me on again. It was great fun, and I will be at your beck and call whenever you need me. I am, yes, one of the hosts of Days of Thunder, a podcast on the Voices of Wrestling podcast network. Every 2 weeks, we take it upon ourselves to view the last few years of WCW through the lens of only watching Thunder and the pay-per-views to see if it makes any more or less sense. That said, we do some dips over to the red brand of WCW and watch Nitro sometimes. We actually just last night recorded our sixth night of Nitro, which was the infamous Ric Flair in the mental hospital episode.
And yet also, you still wanted to talk about wrestling.
I know. It also featured two world title changes. So for people who think that it only got really bad when Russo arrived, I have got a lot of news about the Kevin Nash booking tenure. But you can find us, if you just search Days of Thunder on your podcast app, you'll find our free feed there and the Voice of Wrestling podcast network as well. If you like what you hear on there, we also have a Patreon that you can find at alargemanappears.com. One of the dumbest things I've ever spent money on in my life, that URL. But on there, you can get a lot of our limited series, such as Days of Thunder at the Movies, where we watch bad movies very tenuously linked to professional wrestlers, such as the Jesse Ventura story and Wrong Side of Town, starring Rob Van Dam and Dave Bautista. We also have a series on there where we rewatch all the Clash of the Champions shows. We have Pick Your Poison series, where we get a guest on to talk about one of their favorite WCW wrestlers and work they did outside of WCW, and other kind of dumb ideas that come to us here and there. So that's alargemanappears.com. I think it's all the blogs. I guess at WCW Thunderpod on Twitter, and I'm at The Day to Dave.
Fantastic. I have two subscriptions on Patreon, and one of them is Days of Thunder. I am proud to be on Team Beefy Dar, and it is a fiver well spent every month.
Thank you very much.
There's only two wrestling podcasts that I basically listen to as soon as they turn up in the feed. Days of Thunder is one of them, and the other one is your WWE co-host podcast.
Yes, that will be, I will confirm this now officially for the first time on your podcast, that the sequel to the WWA Christmas special will be coming this year with Liam and Garrett.
Fantastic.
I still flash back to Road Dogg and his WWA tapes kicking in the fucking door.
Oh, who knows what he'll be up to this year.
As for us, all our links can be found at linktr.ee/mustseematches. That's all the ways to subscribe to this podcast. Mark's Twitter, my Twitter, Mark's writing on Post Wrestling and a whole bunch of other stuff. We are still on Melon Husk's hell site at mustseematches. I am at Kieran Edit, and Mark is
at monkey_buckles.
Next week, something I've very much been looking forward to, our only visit to the biggest women's wrestling show of all time, as we'll be taking a look at Manami Toyota versus Aja Kong from AJW's Big Egg Wrestling Universe, which is a fabulous name for a show, on November the 20th, 1994, and we'll be joined by Alex from the Berubara Tag Boom podcast. So come back for that, and we will see you then. Bye.